I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection. You may remember that old TV commercial that showed an elderly woman in a house coat sprawled on the floor, helpless, and she's saying, "I've fallen down and I can't get up." Well, sure, it's a cheesy commercial, and it was easy to parody, and there were a lot of laughs about it, but it is also a very potent image, one that strikes fear into the elderly and also into those who care about them. For grown children, whose parents once picked them up when they fell down, the image of a parent in distress is deeply troubling. And that doesn't make it any easier to have a conversation with aging parents about the next step in their lives. This has never been an easy conversation for parents and their grown children to have, but it's an issue that's getting more attention now as members of the largest bulge in the American population curve face their parents and their own mortality. For better or worse, boomers drive the marketplace of both products and ideas. Just think of no-line bifocals or so-called full-figure jeans. Connection listeners, as aging parents or grown children, have you managed yet to have that conversation about the future? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at theconnection.org. Joining us from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Eleanor Rinzler, who is manager of independent living and long-term care for AARP. And Eleanor, welcome. Your organization has been studying what we're today calling the most difficult conversation. Why is it such a tough conversation to have? And I want to make a correction. I called you Rinzler. Your name is Eleanor Ginsler of AARP.
That's right, John.
My pardons for that. Why is this such a tough conversation to have?
Well, John, it's difficult for a variety of reasons. We know, actually, from the research that we've done, that our adult children and our older parents are thinking about these issues. Adult children are thinking about what's going to happen when mom and dad can't live independently anymore. Older parents are also thinking, what's going to happen in the future if I can't live as independently as I might be living now?
Are the kids and parents thinking about it the same way?
Well, in some respects, we actually think they are. Where the disconnect comes, and it is truly a disconnect, is while they may both be thinking, both sets of family members, they are not talking with each other about this. There is a level of denial that factors in here, and it stops those conversations from taking place.
On whose side is the denial happening?
Actually, I think the denial is very much on both sides. For many adult children, we have found from our research, they feel it is inappropriate and almost disrespectful in some regards to bring up these issues while their parents are healthy. Though at AARP, we would tell you that's exactly when we want these conversations to start happening. Mm-hmm. And for older parents, the thought of becoming dependent and less able-bodied is so distressing and clearly a function of the society in which we live that they don't want to think about it, and they just want to put it off.
What are the consequences of putting it off?
Well, actually, what we believe at AARP is that if you wait for the crisis, which is the mode we most often operate in, you have severely limited your choices. So the scenario of an older parent, as you described earlier in the show, falling down, perhaps breaking a hip, ending up in a hospital, and an adult child getting that scary telephone call that your parent has landed in the hospital, all of a sudden, you're dealing in crisis. You have to quickly arrange for services, make decisions about living arrangements. And if you haven't spoken together as a family unit, you haven't laid any of the groundwork.
And what might a conversation ahead of that have avoided?
Well, I think that the whole idea of the family as a unit talking together about today and tomorrow will actually be a lead.
Well, just on the case of somebody falling down, how could a conversation have headed that off, or how could a conversation have handled that once it happened, if the conversation had happened earlier?
We certainly can't automatically assume that by talking together, you'll prevent falling. But by talking together, you could potentially start looking, for example, at the home in which the older parent is residing. And those conversations don't have to be only about the worst case scenarios. They can be about everything from how is your home doing, Mom? Let's look at it together and make sure that it's still safe for you to be here.
So you might have done something like put in a railing or put lighting in so that that wouldn't happen, because mom might have told you that that maybe she was worried about falling down the stairs, too.
Absolutely. I mean, it could be railings on the staircases. It could be making sure there's double-sided tape on the rugs that could potentially move out from under feet. It could be making sure that in the shower there's a handheld shower. There are actually, you know, very inexpensive modifications you can do to your house so that you can age in your house with your house.
You know, we introduced this as a problem of our times. And I think there's an assumption built into that, maybe a nostalgic one and maybe too rosy about the past, the notion that this is a modern problem because in the past, the parents, the grandparents would have all been with the children for perhaps, you know, to the end of their lives. Is that nostalgic view of things a little bit too rosy, or have things really changed?
Well, I think some things have changed. I think that we do have more families living further apart from each other than we have in the past. But I do think we also need to recognize that caregiving is a family issue, has been a family issue, and will continue to be a family issue. Over three-quarters of the care that is given in this country is given by family and friends. It's not given by paid professionals.
So if you are uncomfortable about having this conversation with your parent, mm-hmm. or if you're the parent and are uncomfortable about having the conversation with the child, mm-hmm. how do you approach it?
There are a couple of suggestions that we make at AARP. We do recognize that this is difficult, and we encourage families to find the courage in themselves to address these issues. I think all families have to be very cognizant of their family dynamics and respect those dynamics. So there are a variety of ideas that we offer that we ask families to consider and select the idea that makes the most sense. One of the ideas is that we urge our adult children to enter into this conversation very much as a dialogue, mm-hmm. not a lecture.
And so the child should not become the parent.
Yeah, we really don't ever want to have that happen. In our nation, we respect adulthood. People are allowed to make choices when they reach majority age, and in no way do we ever want to diminish that. And in fact, our position is if you have these conversations, the older parent actually can maintain more control over their life because they have thought things through, they've communicated things to their adult children. Should they find themselves in a crisis, that adult child knows what mom wants because they've talked about it. And in fact, that older parent will end up with a much more, with decisions being made that are much more matches what they wish for.
Connection listeners, the number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear from Connection listeners about your experiences in this area of the tough conversation. Have you had it? How did it go? Are you afraid to have it? And Eleanor, just from personal experience, I had the experience of having to go to my father's house because the phone was off the hook for mm-hmm. 2 days by mistake, mm-hmm. And we couldn't get through. And when I showed up at the house, he was deep asleep and doesn't hear very well at all. So there was that period of time where I was knocking on the doors and mm-hmm. couldn't wake him. I must admit, thinking the worst, I finally had to
Absolutely.
Break through the door. And when I woke him, he was deeply embarrassed, and I was deeply embarrassed, and we were both embarrassed because we knew what was going through my mind. And mm-hmm. and so we didn't really talk about it after that. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about? Does that sheer embarrassment get in the way of these conversations?
Oh, sure it does. Those feelings are very strong and very powerful. But I guess the other idea that we suggest is that we want our adult children to connect with our older parents and start from your emotional point. I mean, I actually encourage our families to say, have those adult children say, Dad, I'm worried about you. You can do me a favor. You can help me. I need help because I'm worried about this. Here's what I need that you can do that'll make me feel better. It puts that parent in a position of control again.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now Wendy Carberry in Center County, Pennsylvania. She is the aging care manager in the Office of Aging. And Wendy Carberry, you are actually sometimes in the middle of these negotiations between families. Do you agree that it's a very, very sensitive area for kids and their parents to get into?
Oh, absolutely. And I would certainly concur that the family dynamics and very much how the family has functioned through the life of that family kind of comes out in this sort of situation. There certainly are families who are very open and talk about all sorts of things like this and truly do have plans in place. Very often our office, and in my job in particular, because I see people as they are going into some sort of placement, the family may be in crisis. Mm-hmm. And one of the big issues is the children, there may be multiple numbers of children, and they're living in different areas, and they're not all agreeing. Mm-hmm. So this is another thing in terms of the adult children on their own talking among themselves ahead of time, too, to see if they're all in the same ballpark as what they think mom and dad should be doing.
You know, one thing we, on the staff here at The Connection, we talked about ahead of time is the tendency, I think, because all of us on the staff are, you know, on the younger end of this connection, I think both of you are, we wanted to make this, to be careful not to make this into a conversation about the parent as the problem. I think maybe for the parents, sometimes the kids are the problem as well. And the parents have very, very legitimate concerns and powerful feelings. And I would like you to share some of that from your insights about how do the parents feel about, you know, being in the position of, number one, wanting to be independent. Number two, definitely not wanting to be a burden. Tell us about that.
As one of those parents who is a little older and has adult children, I certainly have thought about that and was very fortunate that my own mother shared her feelings ahead of time in terms of her personal wish to be in a nursing home and not, quote, a burden on the family. We have others who very much would like to remain in their own home as long as possible. And the children are seeing this differently. Our office has many programs that looks at the whole span of community help, you know, going on to placement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was unaware that you were at the older end of the spectrum.
Yes.
I have adult
children myself, and having gone through an experience with my mother's death about 6 years ago, and prior to being in this job, being totally unaware of all of the resources that mm-hmm. were available to me, whether it was support groups, medical insurance advice, and that sort of thing, that I have tried to begin putting some of that sort of stuff in place for my own children.
Connection,
actually,
listen, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. We actually have found that that's a very traditional, a very typical scenario to unfold. After an adult child has faced this with their older parent, they often, as a result of that, take a look at themselves and say, now I need to do something so that I'm better prepared and my family members are better prepared as well.
Connection listeners, we're discussing the toughest conversation, that conversation between children and their parents at the point where the parents may not be able to take care of themselves. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear your insights on this issue because all of us have been or will be in this situation. Have you had that tough conversation? How did you do it? I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston, Europe.
I'm John Donvan. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're discussing the conversation you should have, but too many of us don't have, between adult parents and their adult children and their aging parents at the point in life where maybe the parents can't take care of themselves any longer. Our guests are Eleanor Ginsler, Manager of Independent Living and Long-Term Care for AARP, and Wendy Carberry, Aging Care Manager at the Office of Aging in Centre County, Pennsylvania. I'd also like to bring in at this point Lisa Shainwetter, who is a minister at the Memorial Congregational Church in Sudbury, Massachusetts. And Lisa, I've read in the Times recently that in an interesting way, different ethnic groups have different experiences with this whole question because they deal differently with their parents. They may or may not belong to the extended family to differing degrees. Do you see those differences? And are there also differences, perhaps, socioeconomically? Does the experience that an aging parent may have differ depending on where they come from economically?
Yeah, actually, what I know more about the economics of it than mm-hmm. I do about the cultural differences. I formerly served a church that was pretty much working class on the North Shore in Massachusetts, and the experience that I had there was that families felt pretty powerless, and even if they were able, as Eleanor was saying earlier, to have had a conversation about what do we do next, they were so financially limited in the options that they faced that they felt like they just couldn't do anything. And so, as Wendy was saying, that nothing happened until a crisis happened, and you know, the family was gathered around a hospital bedside, really anxious about what do we do next, and the next step had to be taken immediately. I'm now serving a community in Sudbury that's more affluent, and the fact that people here tend, for instance, to have health care, health insurance and good health care, and access as they move through their lives to social workers and therapists and support systems and a whole variety of programs that sort of help elderly folks make a transition maybe from living in their own home for 40 or 50 years into an apartment and then, you know, into more and more help, does seem to make the conversation easier.
And is it more frequent? Do you find that people with more money tend to talk more about these issues?
No.
Less, perhaps?
I'm not sure if it's more or less. Uh-huh. I just think because the health care is better in general, people, elderly folks, don't seem to go from managing on their own okay to crisis. Mm-hmm. Here, people sort of, you know, are able to notice that their, for instance, their physical ability is more and more limited, so the intervention can happen sooner.
I'd like to ask you also, Lisa, the point that I mentioned before, and are wanting to not just see this from the child's point of view, but also from from the aging parent's point of view. What are their concerns? How are they living this moment in this difficult conversation?
I think it's really hard for those of us who are young to appreciate what it is that we younger people and maybe society in general are expecting of our elderly family members, and I think that's very frustrating for older folks. That, you know, they expect a child will look at a single parent living alone in a big house with a huge yard, and all we see is burden
and the weeds and the paint job that needs to be done,
and, you know, the cleaning and all the upkeep, and and what the elderly person living there sees is a lifetime of memories. And you know, in the weedy flower garden, they see the rose bush that they planted to commemorate a special event, or in the peeling paint, you know, that particular coat of paint means something significant. It's a marker for them. And what they see they're being asked to do is to relinquish all of that and all of their possessions, and to drastically alter their lives in a way that they don't see everybody, their children, doing. Frequently, particularly for those of us who are baby boomers, we're still acquiring, and not particularly sensitive to the fact that the values that we have for property and stability and what property means to us in our society are values we learned from our parents, but we're asking them to relinquish all of that, and often because we have such a mobile society these days, parents are being asked to uproot themselves from the community where they have friends.
Right, right.
They have a religious
I asked you to get us into the parents' head, and you did that very powerfully and beautifully. The number to call, Connection listeners, is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's bring in some listeners. Alice, hello, you're on the Connection.
Hello there.
Hi, Alice.
My mother is 91 years old, and I'm a baby boomer. And for the last 13 years, she and I have lived through sort of a living hell on earth due to the fact that we had such an inadequate, woefully, abysmally ignorant conversation on this subject of living when you're no longer able to take care of yourself.
How long ago did you have that conversation?
1989.
She was in her, I'm not doing the 70. Math well, in her 70s at that point. Okay.
Yes, yes. And,
and what was that conversation like? You just described it as a disaster.
Yes, because we didn't know what was in front of us. We went to a church-supported, a beautiful assisted living with fresh flowers in the lobby and beautifully manicured grounds. And I've come to hate every flower in that nursing home because of the woeful lack of care of my mother and other people in that nursing home and in other nursing homes. By the way, I've looked in the Boston area, and I see the same syndrome, that they're so woefully understaffed. And it's as though the beautiful assisted living part, which, of course, she loved it, and they're vocal. They're able to help themselves. They don't realize that there's a little trap called that nursing home on the other side of the campus that looks as beautiful but is so woefully understaffed that they're really just doing the maintenance. Older people who fear nursing homes do so with reason. It's been my experience and other people.
Eleanor Ginsler, what do you hear in what Alice is saying there?
Well, I think Alice brings the reality to this story. She did everything right with her mom. They talked about it. They made a mutual decision together. But we're faced in our culture today with the reality that people are living longer. Now, let's not mistake longer for necessarily totally independently. As we age, there is a statistical correlation to the need for help and the onset of disability. So her mother now, 13 years later, is still alive but needs far more care than she did 13 years ago when she made her decisions.
Alice, how do you fund all of this? How do you pay for all of it?
Well, I'm able to. I'm a software engineer, so I'm able to do that. But the more, I'm paying $7,000 a month.
Wow.
But if it wasn't for me and my children who daily go there, I spend the night in her room, and the roaches as well as the human roaches come out at night, I can assure you.
And that's for $7,000 a month.
Right.
Eleanor, is this a high figure? It's astounding.
The cost of care is escalating quite high these days. That's somewhat at the high end, but she's not alone in that fee. And the care issues are real, and I'm encouraged to hear that Alice is there on a daily basis. We very much believe that the more family members stay involved, the better the care that is going to be received by the care recipient.
Alice, what do you want when it's... when you've reached those years, where do you want to be?
I am well informed now. I have talked to the long-term care insurance people, and my daughter-in-law is an actuary, and she says if you're at all able to save, do it that way, because we insurance companies are in the business of making money. And I was shocked to find out that they only cover you, unless you ask for it, for 3 years in your long-term insurance, which would cost me $3,000 a year. And I know where those statistics come from.
But knowing what you know, do you see yourself in an assisted care facility?
Never. Never.
All right, Alice, thank you very much for your call. Vaughn, you're joining The Connection. Hello.
How do you do today?
Fine, thank you.
I'm a 45-year-old woman, and I've recently returned to my parents' home to take care of them. Since I moved back a year and a half ago, I've received legal guardianship of an elderly aunt, and we all moved in together, basically. My question and a problem that I face on a weekly basis is a certain lack of respect here. I feel that I'm treated by my parents as though I'm 12 years old. I can't make decisions. They won't allow it. Dad's 86, for example. Mom's 76.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a different level of respect from my aunt because, well, you know, we missed a lot of our adult lives. But an example is recently I discovered my aunt wasn't taking her medications.
Mm-hmm.
So I took them, and I said that I would dispense her medications on a daily basis with supper.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't care for this idea at all. She was mad. She spent the whole day mad at me and, acting out in a sense. We had a talk. I told her she could hold her medications as long as she brought them out at supper time, and I could view her taking her medications,
wow.
and that would be fine with me. Now, with my parents, this would never happen.
But it sounds like at every step of the way, you're needing to negotiate. And I want to ask Wendy Carberry, what do you hear going on here?
Well, I hear a lot of the phone calls that we get in our office that our care managers do, and so much of it is on an individual basis as far as the family dynamics. I'm always an advocate of getting a neutral party involved, if possible, whether it's a home care agency, your area agency on aging, your church.
And
you're
the neutral party in your area.
Yes, we are.
How do you get involved in something like that? I'm not asking you to diagnose the situation.
Oh, no.
But how do you get involved? How do you walk into a complicated family dynamic like that and help them sort it out?
Where I don't have the options to make decisions, in the sense that I could never have taken my father's medications the way I took my aunt, the way we discussed it and came to a plan. It never would have happened.
What about that, Wendy?
Sometimes, as I say, I look for allies in this situation. If the family has a very good relationship with their family physician, or a nurse in that office can sometimes help. As I say, sometimes a home care agency, a friend. And a lot of this is the parent-child dynamic that we're hearing. And sometimes it is accepted from someone other than the child, just as we sometimes accept things from someone other than our parents.
Right.
But it is, there's no easy solution. And it often does involve trying to pull in a neutral party.
All right. Thank you. Vaughn, thank you very much for your call. Steve, you're calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, John. I'm a physician here in Providence and have many elderly patients, and this issue comes up fairly frequently. And one thing that I've recommended in situations where parents are living alone and failing physically or otherwise, and is an emergency response system called Lifeline Rhode Island. This is when you made reference to that advertisement of the patient, of the person falling,
yes,
and couldn't get
yeah.
up. That type of response system it responds to any person pressing a button that's worn around their neck.
Is it widely used?
Oh, it's there's an enormously large program here in Rhode Island.
Well, roughly how many customers for that service?
Well, coincidentally, my wife happens to be one of the managers of this nonprofit program here
uh-huh.
in Providence, and there are 700 and some odd elderly or persons living alone who make use of this.
And does it get used often?
Thousands, literally, of calls. Thousands of calls, not for the same individual, obviously, but someone falls or has a problem of some sort that they can't reach the telephone. This button activates a speaker system on the phone, calls a central response system center who has their medical history and responds, Mrs. Jones, you're having a problem.
Yeah.
And it's just a wonderful thing for peace of mind for the adult children, knowing that their parent is...
Let me take that thought to Lisa Shainwetter in Sudbury. What Steve is talking about, in a sense, is using technology to extend the sense of independence for an older parent. Are these the serious things to be considered, and are there other ways to try to postpone that day of having to move out?
Yeah, I was listening to him and thinking, I do have parishioners who use that kind of a system, and it's very reassuring for them to have it. But my anecdotal experience is that there's a lot of depression among elderly folks, and part of that, I think, is related to normal aging issues like limited physical mobility and other physical and mental problems are just a normal part of aging. But I think there's a bigger problem, which is the tendency that we have in our culture to isolate elderly people. And the folks who seem to cope the best are those who maintain lots of friendships and lots of contacts, even beyond, beyond their families. And in this area, families often aren't nearby. So it's not surprising that I would say this, but people who have a church community or some kind of religious community and maintain an active connection feel like there's help for them when they need it. And
not just the family then.
Yeah, no. In fact, the problem with relying only on your family is you don't have peers often. And
basically because everybody's younger than
right.
you.
Right. You're often the only one left in your generation. One of the things that I observe have observed over the years in my congregations is that elderly folks will take care of one another in a way that's acceptable to them, but would not be acceptable from younger people.
Lisa, how did you work this all out with within your own family and your own parents?
There's an assumption, huh?
You have not had the tough conversation.
We've had some of them. My parents live in Wisconsin, and they're young and very healthy, but I have a very elderly grandmother, and my dad is paying very close attention to what it's like, or what it's like for him having to cope now with her care. And my grandmother is 96 and recently fell, and he's had to negotiate on her behalf for care. And he's a physician, so I think we all assumed that at least at the medical end of things, he'd be really well equipped to handle this, and it would be smooth sailing. And what he's finding out is that it's not. Mm. And even figuring out, you know, does she need assisted living? Does she need?
But has his experience with his parents prompted you to start talking about these things with your parents?
Yeah, it has.
And how comfortable, how smooth a conversation is that?
I think that my conversations are pretty typical of everybody else's. I think that I don't understand all of the issues, and my parents will say to me, but you don't understand, you know, we have these responsibilities and we can't just ignore that. And I will say, yes, but, you know, we need to start preparing. And I think the strength of the relationship is at least we're trying.
And that seems to be the point.
Yeah, I think it is the point.
Lisa Shainware, I'd like to thank you for joining us at The Connection.
You're very welcome.
Lisa is minister at Memorial Congregational Church in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Connection listeners, we're discussing the tough conversation between children and their adult parents at that point in life where the parents may need a little extra help and may have trouble facing that. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
I'm John Donvan. You're listening to The Connection. We're discussing the tough conversation between adult children and their parents at that point in life where parents may not be able to take care of themselves, and it can be an awkward, uncomfortable conversation that often doesn't take place in some families. Our guests are Eleanor Ginsler, Manager of Independent Living and Long-Term Care for AARP, and Wendy Carberry, Aging Care Manager in Center County, Pennsylvania's Office of Aging. And Wendy, we touched on this before briefly, the enormous cost that families may incur at the point when the point comes to begin paying for care for an older parent. What happens to an older parent's assets at this point in life? In addition to having the conversation, say you have it, then where are you financially?
Well, this is another thing that depends very much on the spectrum. Certainly, we have some people who can privately pay as long as possible. The majority of people can't. We certainly have people who are clearly medical assistance recipients from the beginning, but what often happens is that someone will go into a facility and have to spend down their assets to a certain point, and then medical assistance kicks in. Now, if there is a spouse or a dependent child still at home, part of that money, they're not left high and dry. Mm-hmm. The house is not grabbed away. There is certainly a lot of fear in this whole area, and it's certainly something that I highly recommend people. There are some very good booklets through Social Security, through AARP, that really will help people do this. We have a volunteer health insurance advice program through our Office of Aging here that people sit down, because I think that sometimes this is the thing that makes people stop and say immediately they're going to take my house away. And there are even provisions in our state, I don't know about other states, for people who are just in assisted living. If they are lower income, we have a state supplement in our particular state.
You know, but it sounds like you're saying you really have to plan for this.
Absolutely.
Planning is very crucial.
Absolutely. And doing your homework ahead of time. I have in front of me, Eleanor, I'm sure, is probably familiar with it. I'm not sure whether it's old or not, but it's called a Caregiver Guide to Information and Resources.
Yes, I am familiar with that.
AARP has the hotline for the elder care locator that can hit you up with numbers all over the country in terms of your area agency on aging. Wonderful resource.
All right. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255 for The Connection, 1-800-423-TALK. Walter, welcome to The Connection.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. It's funny that you talk about baby boomers, because I'm 30, my sister's 32, my parents are 74 and 78, so we probably should have been, you know, born as baby boomers, but we end up being Gen Xers. And we're starting to have those kind of conversations with my parents now. I mean, pretty much it's gone to the one extreme of, like, well, they're just talking about, well, when we die, we just want to be cremated. That's the easiest and cheapest and least expensive way. But both my sister and I, we're starving artists. We've pretty much tried to work in Boston for 5 years, and, you know, tried doing that in Boston. You end up sort of worse off than you started with. And
don't give up.
Yeah, it's kind of like, oh boy, I don't know. But you know, I hear someone talking about $7,000 a month for healthcare. I'm like, I think I've had some years when I only made $7,000.
So you just can't do it. You can't help them.
No, I know. I can't. I mean, thankfully, they're in very good health right now. I mean, they're both living at home. We did have a time about a year and a half ago when one went to the hospital for something, and then the other one, as soon as, my father came out, my mother went in, and then, like, my mother came out and my father went in because he couldn't deal with the stress of living alone when she was in there. And it drove my sister and I to, like, to almost to the point where we were, you know, it was horrible. And thankfully, we've patched that up, and we've, you know, because, you know, we're going to need each other when, you know, inevitable things start happening with our parents.
Eleanor Ginsler of AARP. I mean, again, we're hearing Walter's had the conversation, and there's not much more he can do after that.
Well, I think he can be as well prepared as possible, and you're right. There's no automatic answers here. I think we have to be critically aware that there's an awful lot that folks don't know they don't know, in a way that makes sense. An incredible myth that exists in today's world is, I don't have to worry about paying for this. I have Medicare. My mom doesn't have to worry. She's on Medicare. Medicare does not cover long-term care.
Walter,
an enormous number of people don't know that.
I'd like to thank Walter for his call. Jessica, you're on The Connection. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling because, similar to Walter, I'm 31, and my grandparents are actually the issue. We are a family of my grandparents and then their children, my mother and my aunt and my uncle, and then myself. And there's sort of a blurred line between my status and the family, but they are older and alternately in and out of the hospital. Last year, my grandmother, this year, my grandfather. And at both points, they ended up in nursing homes. But basically, they are each first-generation parents of immigrants and from Hungary and Poland. And there is no expectation, I think, for any sort of long-term care in the nursing home. It is expected, I think, that they will be at home. And growing up, we've had people in our home. My grandfather's mother's friend from Hungary died in our home, as did my grandmother's mother. And I think that there is some resentment. We're all trying to juggle. My aunt is closest and is bearing the brunt of the whole situation. My uncle occasionally helps. But my mother's flying in from California once a month, and I'm driving down from Boston to Connecticut about once every other weekend, or it's been once a week lately. And it's difficult not only for our peers to really understand, my peers especially, to understand why I'm so invested, but also just like the entire family is trying to juggle keeping morale up, keeping the house up, keeping, you know, I mean, when I go there, it's like make breakfast, clean up after breakfast, mow the lawn, get everybody dressed, run over to the nursing home, run back, make dinner, go shopping.
Are you carrying this burden pretty much alone, or are you getting help from others in the family?
Well, no, there are, my aunt is actually carrying most of it, and on the weekends I try to go help her. And my uncle is, you know, we're all sort of getting bits and pieces, and my grandparents feel a bit resentful because they don't feel that, you know, any one person is doing 100%.
Yes.
Because we're all trying to pick up a little bit for each.
Well, Eleanor Ginsler, do you think part of what Jessica's talking about, she made the allusion to the cultural connection that her parents as immigrants kind of expect a more traditional approach. They expect to be taken care of at home. Is that in effect there? And I mentioned earlier there's this New York Times piece about the fact that cultural expectations and practices are different in this regard.
Yeah, actually, we just did a very interesting study looking at the people who are in the middle, is what we called it at AARP, those people who are both raising children and dealing with aging family members. And we were able to survey in such a way that we have information about ethnic diversity and the differences and similarities therein. The good news about this story is that for all, and we have information on Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, African Americans, and non-Hispanic whites. And the good news is family is very important across all of these ethnicities, and care for family members is very important across all these ethnicities. There are cultural implications, and in some of our cultures, taking care of family and the expectation that children will help take care of family is higher than in others. Real quickly, it was in the Asian ethnic group that we found the highest expectation for children to care for their older parents, 73%.
And is the expectation being met? Are younger generations of Asian Americans caring for their parents more?
Actually, they are, in fact. Mm-hmm. There are large numbers that are providing care. The highest percentage of folks who are involved in elder care of their older parents were the Asian Americans. I think we are struggling, as Jessica so aptly puts it. It's a patchwork that we end up putting together, and the dynamic that and this could be a myth that in years gone by it was the one of the daughters just took in the older parent and just carried on. We have two people working families these days. It's a much more difficult juggling act. But it's being done.
I still get the impression, listening to Jessica, that a lot of this is still seen as women's work in any case.
It is,
yes,
still.
It is. Sorry. In our family.
It is a women's issue. You absolutely must acknowledge that from both sides of the coin. Women are more often the caregivers. Women are more often the care recipients because they're living longer.
Jessica, thank you for your call. Kevin, you're on The Connection.
John, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment and see what your guest thought around the difficult piece of the conversation can be sort of prying into or trying to elicit that financial information. I heard a lot about costs and so forth. And I think that folks need to remember to respect our parents for the lifetime of work they've done, the savings, the pension they worked so hard to get. It's an invasive topic to approach with your parents. And I think that frequently that can be one of the most difficult things you have to talk with your folks about, is how would you pay for this, from something as minimal as a home health aid to something as long-term as permanent nursing home placement.
Eleanor, I'd like you to take that on. Yeah,
that is, John has raised such a critically important issue.
Kevin.
And we absolutely agree that the financial conversation is probably the hardest one. One of the things which we've suggested is don't start there, even if that is in your head the most important piece of information to get. You're not going to get it if that's the first area of conversation, and there are very likely such obstacles in terms of sort of breaking down that barrier. Start with something else far less threatening.
Eleanor, also I think would be the legal issue. At some point, parents may be in the position of having to sign away bits of control to their kids, financial control, perhaps control over medical issues. And can a parent end up feeling in an adversarial relationship with a child in a situation?
Actually, I do think if it's not handled properly, it can be a destructive instead of a helpful situation. And what we at AARP try to get across is that if an older parent makes a decision to, for example, complete an advance directive and designate somebody to be an agent in a healthcare durable power of attorney, that's their way of maintaining control because they are directing that individual to do their work for them should they not be able to speak on their own behalf.
I still feel, in a way, as I listen to everything we've said, that we're still talking about the child having to start a conversation and feel his way through a conversation and be sensitive toward the parent. Does the parent have a responsibility to start this conversation and to engage in this conversation?
When we did some earlier research at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, one of the messages that we heard from our adult children is that they are actually looking for an invitation from their older parent that it's okay to do this. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of a sign, not necessarily that the older parent is only the one to bring it up, but that they give an indicator that it's okay to talk about this. It's actually a gift you can give your adult child.
Wendy, do you, in your experience in Pennsylvania, the Office of Aging, you feel that same way? Do you see that signal has to come from the parent, and do parents think carefully about that, or is it a little bit more instinctive than that?
Well, I think sometimes it goes more smoothly when it is initiated by the parent for many reasons. And on an encouraging note, I do get calls, or we have people who walk in and say, give me all the information you can. I want to be as independent as long as I can. I don't want to be a burden on my kids, and I want to know what my options are. Mm-hmm. So I think we really do have people looking at this, too, and our job here is so much is to support that and to encourage it for the least restrictive of level of care for people and to stay home as long as possible.
So all in all, it sounds like a conversation that must be had as difficult as it is to have it. I'd like to thank our guests, Eleanor Ginsler, who is the Manager of Independent Living and Long-Term Care for the AARP. We also spoke with Wendy Carberry, an aging care manager for Center County in Pennsylvania, and Lisa Shainwetter, minister of the Memorial Congregational Church in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation on our online forum at theconnection.org. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection.
This is W.